Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 25th of May. This hour of the program, Evan Thomas is joining us. His book, The War Lovers, Roosevelt Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. It looks at a period in American history that I think that many of us don't know all that much about. His narrative, he says, spans the years of America's war fever from 1895 to 1899. And then he picks up the story of man's love for war a half century earlier with the fantasies of a rich boy in a house on a hill. And he ends it on Omaha Beach on D-Day, June 6th, 1944. As any book, there must be a conclusion, but the story is never ending. This particular book features a lot of fascinating people in history, some of whom we also don't study very much. Teddy Roosevelt and Henry Cabot Lodge, influential politicians who had this war fever. William Randolph Hearst, a fascinating guy who never met a war perhaps he didn't like and did a great deal to stir up interest in war in this country. On the other side, Roosevelt's former teacher, William James, philosopher, and his friend and political ally, Thomas Reed, the Speaker of the House. And they were concerned. Well, the background here is that on February 15th, 1898, the American ship, the USS Maine, exploded in Havana Harbor. And now this book looks at what actually happened. The people who saw that there was going to be a disaster here, the others who wanted to send troops to Cuba and to the Philippines, and what the truth was of the USS Maine. And a look at, you know, the forming of a philosophy which has guided America in, some may say, some misguided adventures over the course of the next many, many years. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Evan. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you could do that. It's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Evan Thomas is the author of a number of books, Sea of Thunder, John Paul Jones, Robert Kennedy, The Very Best Men, Amanda Seale, and The Wise Men. He is an editor-at-large at Newsweek magazine. And Evan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen. Good to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. I hardly know where to start because all of these characters are so fascinating. I mean, they're really interesting people. But I'm wondering about you focusing on this part of history that, to tell you the truth, I didn't know very much about it. And I don't think many of us know very much about this particular era. And it was crucial to our understanding of later history. So are we ashamed of it?
Well, I think that we're ashamed of pieces of it. I mean, people were pretty, they talked about race, for instance, in ways that are embarrassing today. You always have to understand people in the context of their times. But if you look at what they're saying literally about the dominance of the Anglo-Saxon race and so forth, it all, I mean, it makes you cringe a little bit in modern times. But there are certain things that were true then that are true today, and I wanted to get at some of that, some of the kind of universal truths. About the nature of war and why men, particularly men, are drawn to it. So it has some relevance for today, certainly. But it's also just an incredibly fun period in our history. I mean, that turn of the century was such a rich time when America's feeling its oats and decided it's conquered one frontier and is looking for new frontiers. And as these kind of larger than life characters, Teddy Roosevelt, certainly William Randolph Hearst, kind of the sort of people it's hard to imagine today in our more cautious and circumspect political worlds where, you know, you can't, if anything you say is going to be on cable TV in 2 seconds.
Exactly.
They didn't worry about that in 1898.
Right.
So we're actually pretty politically incorrect in their letters. So it's a very, you know, it's a rich period, fun characters, and it has some resonance today.
Right. Let's start then with Roosevelt, who has this vision of himself, you know, on a horse leading the charge. Dressed, I didn't know he dressed the way that he did. There's just a group of great stories about how he comported himself. But this vision that people had, and you write about the philosophers of the time and those who thought war was the be-all and end-all and others who had problems with this. But Roosevelt had this. Can you tell me who was the philosopher who was letting them think that war was glorious? It's okay if you die this way, if you're charging men up a hill or down a hill and fighting for what? What are you fighting for?
Well, manhood. There, people were just obsessed with virility back then. Their correspondence is soaked with references to this fear of seeming womanlike or being impotent or being homosexual. They had a terrible fear of somehow not being seen as men, or men as they understood it, which is maybe a little bit different from today. The gender studies people, I obviously did a lot of academic reading for this, and the gender studies people, I think, got it about right. That there was this kind of fear of underlying this was a certain fear of what they called the new woman, who somebody I might want to vote or ride a bicycle or do these scary forbidden activities. So that's part of the story of that age. There is also this kind of eternal restlessness of young men who've forgotten how horrible war can be. I mean, the Civil War had been. Mm. I look back in time as well, and the Civil War was. More than 30 years ago, and it's like we forget that how terrible war can be.
Yeah, exactly. There are a lot of women in the book as well. One of the things about Roosevelt that's always struck me is this enormous tragedy, if you would outline for us, where he loses his wife, he loses his mother within a couple hours, and then he has this daughter, and he just sort of neglects her, it seems to me, to go off and lead his charges.
Hunt buffalo, yeah. I mean, they had different notions of child rearing in those days, to put it mildly. And Roosevelt, as you said, he loses his mother and his wife within 24 hours. What an incredibly stunning blow. And he loses his wife in childbirth, and she has this daughter, Alice. Roosevelt basically lets his sister raise Alice, something that Alice, of course, never forgave him. And he goes off west to hunt. And he has this idea that black care cannot ride on a horse that's moving fast. And he needs to keep moving. And so he does. And he goes and he hunts buffalo and he hunts big game and he hunts grizzly bears. But he can never quite find the ultimate challenge. And he rates hunting by degrees of peril to the hunter. From lower-level animals to panthers and grizzly bears. But, of course, what's the most dangerous game? It's man. And although Roosevelt tracks some horse thieves out there, he never has the really essential experience of combat. And that's what he craves. In his letters, he keeps hoping that a war will break out, a war against Mexico or Spain or Germany or England or Canada. He doesn't really care as long as it's a war, because he needs to have this experience, and he's 39 years old with a family of four and a sick wife and a child who's having a nervous breakdown when he finally gets his war. But he leaves his job and he goes to it. He writes that years later, he writes his military aide saying, I would have turned from my wife's deathbed to go to this war.
Isn't that something? And for a while, that fever kind of subsides, but it comes back, as you write, later in his life.
It does. I mean, the portrait of Roosevelt in my book is critical and in some ways not very appealing. But as I say, I think he was a great president. I think he really was great. He belongs on Mount Rushmore. Certainly his progressivism and all of his domestic legislation and his just courage and standing up to the trust, that kind of thing. But he had this war lust, and he seemed to get it out of his system. He charges up San Juan Hill. I describe it. In the book, I mean, he just glories in it, and he shoots a Spaniard at the top, and it's as if that relieves him of an emotional burden. And when he's president, he's pretty moderate. He talks about speak softly but carry a big stick, but he never uses the stick. And he keeps America out of war. He wins the Nobel Peace Prize for resolving a war between Russia and Japan. But as you say, when he's out of office, then it's as if the fever returns.
Mm-hmm.
And he's determined to get into World War I. Well, now he's 57 years old, and he goes to President Wilson and offers to, or wants to, raise a division to fight in France against the Germans. And Wilson doesn't want to do this. Wilson doesn't want to make a martyr out of Roosevelt. And as Roosevelt's leaving the White House, he says, oh, doesn't he understand? I just want to die. And when Wilson's aide, Colonel House, who's sick of Roosevelt by now, said, oh, did you make that point quite clear to the president?
And let's talk a little bit about the friendship. And it was a very, very strong friendship between Henry Cabot Lodge and Roosevelt.
Lodge, a figure who's pretty obscure now in history, was a cold, chilly, sort of a, like a parody, a caricature of a uptight New England WASP. But Roosevelt loved him. Roosevelt just regarded him as his dearest friend. He called him Delicious Cabotty. You know, when people wrote letters in that age, it was kind of florid and sentimental, and called him Delicious Cabotty. And they had this great affection, and Roosevelt just saw past the coldness, although he recognized it was there. And they shared a vision of politics that was, if the reformers had their heads up in the clouds, they were known as mugwumps, and they couldn't get anything done. They made good principles, but they were ineffective. Mean on the other side were the machine, you know, effective but corrupt. And Roosevelt and Lodge has this view that you had to be principled, but you also had to be effective. You had to make compromises, and you had to get things done. And they had this little gang of two that helped launch a political movement that did get things done, progressivism. On the foreign policy side, Lodge had this dream of America as a great naval power, a great sea power that would supplant Great Britain. He was, in a way, America's first globalist. He was certainly an imperialist, although they didn't use that word, imperialist, because that was kind of a European word, mm-hmm. had bad connotations. But certainly Lodge was the first statesman, really, to articulate a vision of the United States as a great global power with a great navy, possessions. And very rapidly, they annex Hawaii during this period. They invade Cuba. They annex Puerto Rico. Guam is a coaling station. And the Philippines, all the way halfway around the world.
The philosophy of American exceptionalism you write about, and I'm wondering if this guy was pivotal in the thoughts of Roosevelt. He heard this guy, what's his name, Frederick Jackson Turner arguing that American exceptionalism was rooted in the individualism and self-reliance of the frontier settler. When you think of Roosevelt, that's what you think of, this self-reliant guy in so many different aspects of his life. Was he a crucial philosopher in helping Teddy come up with his idea of who Americans were and should be?
Well, of course, Teddy claimed to have already had this idea. Teddy Roosevelt's ego was such that he didn't need to get this from Turner. He already had it, but he liked the fact that Turner popularized it. And Turner is remembered for giving a speech at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893 that said that the frontier is closed, that we've already conquered the frontier, so we have to find new frontiers. Now, that makes, you know, anybody who's flown over the United States sees that there's still a lot of open spaces out there, but that was the perception that we had conquered the West, and now we needed... All dynamic great nations need something new to conquer. And so Roosevelt latched onto this idea and wrote Turner and said, I've been saying this all along, and I agree with you. And so he used that speech, although he thought that Turner was merely sounding themes that he, Roosevelt, had articulated in other forums.
William Randolph Hearst, let's move to him, a fascinating portrayal of him in this book. Father kind of ignored him. I love these family stories. Mother gave him everything he wanted. He wasn't the best of students and went through a heck of a lot of money, didn't he?
He sure did. He knew how to burn money. Hearst was a... father had discovered was a great wildcatter and on finding copper mines and silver mines, the big mother lodes of the 19th century, and so there was a lot of money to burn. In fact, Hearst's mother, she tried to drain all of her assets by spending all her money on newspapers. She had enough money. She built Berkeley, interestingly. The beautiful buildings at the University of California, Berkeley, were built by Phoebe Hearst.
Oh.
So she had a lot of dough.
I guess.
But Hearst spent it about as fast as he possibly could on trying to create this newspaper empire, and that's central to my story. He helps invent sensationalism. He and Joe Pulitzer help invent what they called at the time, crime and underwear journalism. this idea that, you know, sex and violence sells, not kind of an obvious idea to us now, but not quite so obvious back then because they pioneered it. But, of course, what really sells is conflict, and what's the greatest conflict? War. So, first, it was just determined to get the United States into a war because it would sell a lot of newspapers. And, indeed, I believe on the day the war was declared, his newspaper passed a million circulation for the first time.
You start the book, the intro starts, though, with this message sent to all Hearst editors from Hearst. The chief instructs not to press the campaign against communism any further. He wishes the campaign held back for a while, particularly the editorials. He feels we have been pressing the fight too hard for too long and might be arousing war hysteria.
Yeah, war hysteria. I mean, the irony of this is just endless. I begin the book with it because it's hilarious that William Randolph Hearst, of all people, is going to be worried about editorials that stir up war fever. This was his stock in trade. It was his greatest claim to fame. In fact, I'm sure many of your listeners have seen the movie Citizen Kane.
Sure.
Well, Orson Welles, this is all based on Hearst. And they have this famous story, which is possibly apocryphal, of a reporter saying, well, nothing happening down here in Cuba. And Hearst replies, well, you provide the words, I'll provide the war. Something like that may have happened with the illustrator, Frederick Remington, the great illustrator of the West, who Hearst did send to Cuba to draw pictures. And Remington, at least according to Hearst's editor, wired saying, hey, nothing happened here. I want to come home. And Hearst allegedly said, you provide the pictures and I'll provide the war. Hearst later denied this, and I don't know what the truth is, but it certainly captured his spirit. There's no doubt that Hearst, in fact, when war is finally declared, Hearst triumphs. How do you like the journal's war? His newspaper is called the New York Journal. There's nothing shy about William Randolph Hearst. And then he goes to the war. I mean, you know, we've had a lot of publishers in modern times who have pushed for war, but that wasn't good enough for Hearst. He went there, and he took with him, I love this, he took with him a score of correspondents, of course, but 12 yachts, a giant hot air balloon, a printing press, the first motion picture camera ever to be used to take photos of a war, and two New York showgirls dressed in sailor suits. His mistress, Millicent, and her sister Anita, and he Hearst was went to the band. I talk about, you know, I write about Teddy Roosevelt charging up San Juan Hill and the bullets flying. Well, Hearst was right there, a mile away. Put a pistol in his belt. Got up in the morning. Put a pistol in his belt. Put on his necktie. He and his valet went out with a picnic lunch.
His valet.
They tried to find the battle, and they went to the wrong place initially. But a few days later, Hearst is on his yacht following a naval battle. I mean, this is all, you know, beyond belief, at least in modern terms. And a Spanish ship is sunk. What does Hearst do? He goes into the beach with his pistol, and he captures 29 Spanish prisoners. I mean, can you imagine Roger Ailes, you know, going off to Iraq and capturing some, you know, jihadists with his pistol? It's just all kind of, everything was sort of larger than life. And then Hearst makes him give a cheer for Old Glory and then gets a receipt, gives the prisoners to the Navy and gets a receipt, which he keeps for the rest of his life.
I can see why you were fascinated by this period in history. Would it be safe to say, Evan, no Hearst, no sending troops to Cuba and the Philippines?
Well, you know, scholars can argue about this cause and effect. Certainly, Hearst did his best to stir the pot on us going to war in Cuba. And then Teddy Roosevelt plays a role in this. Teddy Roosevelt, as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, dispatches an American fleet under Admiral Dewey to be ready to fight the Spanish fleet if war breaks out, because there's a Spanish fleet in Manila Harbor in the Philippines. And they do, and Dewey sinks the Spanish fleet. Well, the next thing you know, the Americans have occupied the Philippines. This wasn't part of the plan. And it's not as if the Americans they want to be regarded as liberators because they're freeing the Philippines from Spanish rule. But it doesn't quite work out that way. The Filipinos just regard the Americans as occupiers, and a war breaks out, a counterinsurgency. I mean, a, you know, obvious comparison to Iraq here. In fact, we lost 4,000 men in the Philippines, same number that we've lost in Iraq. People have forgotten that we had a war with the Philippines, but we
sure did.
And it was a vicious war. we borrowed a torture from the Spaniards known as the water cure, which was waterboarding. It's the first recorded use of waterboarding. And they tortured us, we tortured them. But counterinsurgencies are, you know, ugly things, as we've discovered in more modern times.
Yeah. And in terms of the Philippines, did Teddy Roosevelt's views on race, which really were way out there for some time, did they determine why we were there, his view of other races?
Well, we did have this general ideology that we were the great conquering race, and all the great, Roosevelt gave a famous speech in which he said, all the great masterful races have known the supreme triumphs of war. And he believed that, you know, he wrote books about the conquest of the West, and they are essentially endorsing, now again, this is in our modern terms, endorsing genocide, you know, wiping out the Indians.
Yes, yeah.
And so you kind of cringe as you read this stuff, but it was the prevailing scholarship of the day. I mean, the great centers of this idea of racial dominance were Harvard and Yale. The leading universities preach social Darwinism, this idea that the great Anglo-Saxon race is dominant and going to inevitably conquer. It wasn't just theory, it was science, as they understood it. Roosevelt, to his credit, although he seems like a horrendous racist by modern standards, in his time was actually sort of moderate, because he believed that other lesser races, as they were known, would eventually adopt the characteristics of the master race, and we'd all eventually blend together. That was considered to be moderate thought. Those are the restrained races. And before I make too much fun of Roosevelt, he did have, it was a sort of a goodness about him, even as he was spouting off about this stuff. He wanted people to get along. He wanted there to be one nation, one America. And he didn't really, you know, he was not a cruel racist the way some of his friends were.
Hmm. We're speaking this hour with the author of The War Lovers, Roosevelt Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. Evan Thomas is our guest, and we'll start taking phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Evan is the author of a number of bestsellers, Sea of Thunder, John Paul Jones, Robert Kennedy, The Very Best Men, The Man to See, The Wise Men. He is an editor at large at Newsweek magazine. We have to ask him about Newsweek, too. We'll wait to the end. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls, starting with Rick from Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Oh, hi. I'm having a little trouble hearing you. This is an era of history that I get a kick out of. I wish I knew more about it. I tend to think it's these extremely remarkable men were the product of extremely remarkable women. I think that the women of this time, the wives, the mothers, somehow, with the way they raised these men as children, they created men of exceptional vision, exceptional courage, men who were just proud as punch of America and of being Americans. I said I'd give a little vignette of what happened when President Theodore Roosevelt came to Milwaukee. He gave a speech. There's a little plaque there. It's just off about somewhere around 2nd and Wisconsin Avenue. And some left-wing anarchist pulled out a gun and actually shot the president right in the chest. When the Milwaukee authorities asked him, "Mr. President, you want to be taken right away to the hospital?" That tough little guy says, "Nah, I'm going to finish my speech first." And the speech, I think, was fairly lengthy. And only after that did he go to the hospital. And he was wounded, and he knew it. But, I mean, that's what a tough kind of guy that was. And, you know, I think the last president we had like that probably was Harry Truman, who also came from Independence, Missouri, you know, a border town where people disembarked for the West, you know, a town full of gamblers and houses of prostitution and whatnot. And I think we got through the Cold War because the Soviet Union was the most powerful and the most evil empire that the world had ever seen, but Truman wasn't afraid of them, not at all.
All right, let's talk about...
I love that story about Teddy. Yes, the speech went on for an hour. You're absolutely right.
It's amazing.
He was bleeding, The bullet, as I recall, the folded speech in his glasses case stopped the impact of the bullet, but it still penetrated his skin and broke a couple of ribs. And yet he felt that he had to. He was always, law life was a test for Teddy Roosevelt. He was always showing his toughness, and he was tough. In fact, it's interesting. One of the reasons why he had to go to war, even though he's 39 years old and had four kids and a sick wife, he just had to go to war because he'd been talking so much about war. He thought he'd be regarded as a phony if he didn't go himself, that he'd be seen as a hypocrite if he didn't go himself. So off he went. His friends thought he was completely nuts and told him so, that he, you know, he was, what are you doing? And yet his boss, who wrote in his diary the night that Roosevelt gave up his job as Assistant Secretary of the Navy to enlist in the volunteer cavalry, wrote that, you know, his friends think he's crazy, but, and yet, well, what will happen if some great thing happens? And then years later, John Long, who wrote this diary entry, writes at the bottom, well, actually, he went into the Army and went straight to the presidency. He was right. We were wrong. And it's just one of these, you know, wonderful turns of history that Roosevelt's just outrageous adventurism really resulted in him becoming a hero and then ultimately becoming president.
Yeah. And that plaque is inside the Hyatt now. I went to search for it some months ago after that reference came up. And so you can see it. There's a reference to that. In terms of the women, start with the story. If you've seen the movie Glory, which is a wonderful film, you'll know. Well, you won't know about his sister, her story is incredible.
It is. Josephine Shaw Lowell was the sister of Robert Gould Shaw. Now, you may, your listeners will remember this wonderful movie. If they haven't seen this movie, they should. It made me cry. It was so good. Mm-hmm. It's about this rich kid who takes on a black regiment in the Civil War and leads them to glory. They find their pride, and then they attack this Confederate redoubt in South Carolina, and most of them are killed, including Shaw. And Shaw's sister, Josephine, who is also married to another war hero who also gets killed, is a huge war lover. And she tells the story of Shaw, the story that you see in the movie. She tells that story herself to little Teddy Roosevelt, who's about 5 years old, 6 years old. And it's his first taste of the martyrdom and glory of war. And he and Lodge later write a book called Hero Tales for little kids. And the sort of the climax of this is the story of these two Harvard boys, Shaw and Lowell, who went off to war. Well, Shaw's sister and Lowell's widow, Josephine, is a character in my book because she indoctrinates Roosevelt on the glories of war, and yet as time goes on, she turns against war. And by the time of the Spanish-American War, she's completely turned against it and wonders what we're doing, adventuring around the world and conquering other countries, and misses the kind of idealism of the Civil War and can't understand what these commercial wars are all about. She was the Lady Bountiful of New York. She was one of the first to really get charity going in New York. Marvelous figure in her own right. I wanted to make her a major character in my book, but the paper trail just wasn't extensive enough. But she deserves her own place in history.
Oh, she was intriguing. I can see why you were captivated by her.
And to this point of the strong women, there were some. The men were a little scared of them. Because women were, there was this idea, it's a little contradictory, but it was this age that's obsessed with virility, but also this age of a new woman. And Roosevelt was blessed, his second wife, his first wife was a bit of a China doll, but his second wife was a formidable woman, Edith Roosevelt. And she stood by Roosevelt, but she also knew how to tease him. I love that after Roosevelt became this great hero charging up San Juan Hill, she herself went to Cuba and went to San Juan Hill. And when she came back, she said, you know, Teddy, I've been there, and it's not that big a hill. It's kind of a little hill. I went there myself a couple of years ago. It looked big enough to me if somebody's in the top shooting down at you. But you know, it's always good to have a wife who can punch you, you know, pop your balloon.
Right.
I'm blessed with that myself. I think actually really important to Roosevelt to have this wife. And Lodge, Henry Cabot Lodge, had a very formidable wife who teased him. Her nickname for him was Pinky, which is a little bit deflating for somebody who took himself so seriously.
Right. Thanks, Rick, for the call. Brad in Jefferson, hi.
Hey there, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Not too bad.
Good.
Yeah, it's strange how history repeats itself, and I don't think it's because people don't want to learn. I think there's certain entities out there that want these inconvenient truths to be hidden away so people don't learn. But I was wondering if you could speak to the influence of the war profiteers on these individuals, especially like the owners of finance, weapons and military manufacturers, maybe owners of oil companies.
Yeah. Well, there's no question that this is a thread that runs through our history. I'm working now on a biography of Dwight Eisenhower, and he famously warned against the military-industrial complex after he was leaving the presidency. So there's no question that profit is a motivator in war. However, I have to say that in what I write about, I went in there expecting more of this. I don't think that big business was driving the train on going to war in 1898. They later bought into it, but in the correspondence between Henry Cabot Lodge and all of his business buddies, the businessmen are actually resisting the war because they think it's going to be bad for the stock market. They think it's going to actually hurt our prosperity. We're just recovering from a panic of 1893, still recovering from it. And there's actually, the business community is initially against the war. Now, once the war broadens and we're conquering the Philippines, business community gets more excited about it because they're seeing potential profit in empire. But they're sort of late to the game. The real forces driving the 1898 war were the more amorphous ones, the ineffable ones about proving your manhood and the eternal lure of war of young men proving themselves. It really wasn't the business community. I take your larger point, though, that profit is often behind these things, and you can point to other examples where that's true.
We need to get to some of these other characters who were looking at the other side of the issues. A Harvard professor who had taught Teddy Roosevelt, worried about war fever. William James, brother novelist Henry James, pretty interesting family, certainly. What was his influence on Roosevelt, and what kind of influence did he have on bringing, hey, let's think about this front and center?
He was. I use him as a kind of Greek chorus in the book of somebody who kind of understands the lure and the pull of war, and he certainly wrote about it at the time. He later came up with this phrase, the moral equivalent of war. What he understood was that war does have this eternal pull, but he also warned that it can be dangerous. One thing that I was very, you know, we were talking earlier about the movie Glory. If you go to, if you see that movie at the very beginning, I think at the end, they show the Shaw Memorial, this beautiful statue, bas-relief, that was it's in Boston at the top of Beacon Hill, of Shaw marching off with his Negro soldiers. And at the dedication of that memorial, William James spoke. And he said, you know, we're here to celebrate courage, but military courage, the fighting courage, that is great, but it's not all that uncommon. People, you know, young men have been shown this for ages. What really was remarkable about Shaw was his civic courage. That he left his regiment of fancy Harvard boys and went off to command a black regiment that was getting no respect and people were kind of sneering at and spitting upon. That took real guts, and that was a unique and exceptional. And that was the speech that William James gave at the dedication of the Shaw Memorial 1 year before the Spanish-American War broke out. And that really got my attention. I thought that was really a really good speech. I should say at the time, people were just sort of politely clapped, but he didn't. Even James knew the speech had been a bit of a bust. But he was on to something. That sometimes there is a greater courage than physical courage. That moral courage comes in a lot of different varieties. And the great triumph. And this is clear if anybody's seeing this movie. It's not his physical courage, although God knows he had that. It's his moral courage,
yes.
and helping these young black soldiers find their themselves.
Yeah, Harvard figures prominently in a lot of these. In terms of you, every now and then I'll weave in somebody like Gertrude Stein, who took James' course, I think, on psychology at Harvard. A lot of the debate and a lot of the characters were at Harvard, weren't they?
Yes, I mean, I'm sort of amused. There's a history of Harvard that says that the Spanish-American War was Harvard's war. Partly, that was the only. There weren't that many. You know, in 1898, there weren't. I guess there was a University of Wisconsin. It was already a good place by then, but it was this, you know, the world of colleges was just smaller, and the upper classes tended to go to Harvard and Yale, so they play a disproportionate influence. And it's sort of funny when we think of Harvard now as being a anti-war place. You know,
yes.
I mean, there's no ROTC there, got kicked off campus, and it was a center of anti-Vietnam protests. But in 1898, it was extremely pro-war because they latched onto this crackpot theory of social Darwinism, this mm-hmm. idea that there's this masterful Teutonic Anglo-Saxon race that was going to dominate the world. All the stuff that sounds loopy now,
yeah, right.
crazy, but was the prevailing orthodox ideology or philosophy of what passed for a ruling class in the United States in 1898. It certainly swept up Roosevelt. And James, who's a professor at Harvard, warns against it. I was so interested in that somebody who's right in the middle of this is saying, no, this is wrong. James was an early pluralist. He invented the word. He had a much greater sense of individual difference and how individuals. He was way beyond his time. He was a sort of multiculturalist. He would have been quite at home in the 1960s, but was way ahead of his time in the 1890s. And that, you know, that interested me.
Yeah. He was Irish, too, huh?
Yeah. Well, that's part of it, actually. Although he's treated as a Brahmin, you know, an aristocratic
right.
Brahmin. He's not quite. You know, he's one step away. And I think his Irish blood gave him a little independence. And help them step aside from the kind of ruling orthodoxies of the time.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi.
Fine topic, fine guest. Reminds me a bit of Scoop. But may I ask a question? Did these people, in the back of their minds, rather than explicitly consider that they were going to be challenging Britain?
Yes.
You know, as the somewhat, you know, it's easy to cast Spain as the degenerate empire, but the chief navy that they were challenging was the British one, and it was shadowing the White Fleet and so on.
Yes. Yes, to answer your question, they were very, very hyper aware of Great Britain, and that was the model. The Admiral Mahan's book about sea power is something that Lodge embraces, and the lesson is Great Britain became a great world power in the 19th century through its navy, and that America has to do likewise. We have to have a great navy. And Lodge and Roosevelt are just obsessed about this. Now, initially, they think about fighting sort of nuttily. In 1895, there's a war fever about fighting Great Britain over a border dispute in Venezuela. How nuts is that? But that really was just shows you how ready the country was for war that they even considered such a thing. But there's a lot of sort of anti-British feeling and that we have to rival Britain and surpass them. Yet in 1898 is really the beginning of what we now call the special relationship, because Britain and the United States get together and form a bond which goes last today. Because why? Because of Germany. Germany's becoming imperialistic at this period, and Britain turns to the United States to make common cause with the Americans, potentially against Germany. And, of course, as we know, in the 20th century, that alliance was at the center of the two world wars.
Hmm. Thanks, Frank, as always, for your calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest this hour is the author of The War Lovers, Roosevelt, Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. Evan Thomas is our guest, and we'll be returning to you momentarily here on the Ideas Network. Here's our first email, Evan, from Kristen in Lac des Flambeaux, who recently read The Imperial Cruise by James Bradley and was horrified by the accounts of the stories of Teddy and his administration during the turn of the century, history she had never heard, the treatment of the Filipino people, handing Korea to Japan, and the extension of manifest destiny and imperialism to Asia, and his views on the supremacy of the white race. Are we really expected to glorify this man and his administration?
Well, I think that Bradley's book is a little bit harsh on Roosevelt. although the portrait I paint of Roosevelt is not too flattering. You have to remember the time, and the time was, at that time, there were these kind of racist, expansionist views. Roosevelt, though, is more complicated than that, because Roosevelt was unquestionably a good president. He that whole progressive era, that's him standing up to the trust, the beginnings of what became the great social legislation of the early 1900s. That's not the kind of thing that a kind of a mean, racist, awful guy does. Also, it's worth noting that although he was had a lot of these views as president, he was not a notable war lover. He kept us out of war. We didn't get in any wars. He talked about speak softly and carry a big stick, but he didn't use that stick. He did build a great navy, but it didn't fight Japan. He was flexing our power without using it, on the theory that if you are prepared, you won't actually have to use your. So Roosevelt is I think history decided that he was a pretty good, deservedly that he was a good president. He has some unsavory views that today are almost embarrassing to discuss, but you have to, it's always important to judge people in the context of their times. And Roosevelt was not quite the monster, I think, that Bradley makes out to be.
Well, he couldn't have been. He's on Mount Rushmore, right?
Well, right. That doesn't necessarily mean he wasn't. But in this case, I think, if you really read the histories of Roosevelt, there was much more good in him than bad.
Dave in West Salem, hi.
Hi. Say, this is a wonderful program. I have to tell you, Sea of Thunder, I think, is just one of the finest books. It just mesmerized me.
All right.
Wow. Thank you.
It was just so catching. But, I was wondering, I had read that after the charge up San Juan Hill, that, was it Mr. Tiffany who died? And I had this impression that Roosevelt kind of went through this sorrow, that it was like, it was this war and being manly, and yet his friends weren't, supposed to die, kind of. And wasn't there something, too, where Stephen Crane was there, and they almost looked down on him because of the red badge of courage and how that viewed war?
Well, war is, when you're actually experiencing it, can be look a little different from when you're just, getting ready to go there. It's true that Crane, the guy who wrote Red Badge of Courage, was on the ridge watching it happen. He felt he needed to go to prove his own physical courage. He did, but in an unintentional way. He was shipwrecked at sea, I think, in a small boat for about a month. Nothing to do with the war, but still helped prove his courage. And he wrote some of the best dispatches from the Spanish-American War. Roosevelt, I tell this tale in my book, but Roosevelt, after he became president, got another dose of war fever and really wanted to go to war. He wanted to die in World War I. And when President Wilson turned him down, because he was a 57-year-old guy, didn't want to send him off to war and make a martyr at him, Roosevelt encouraged his children to go, his four sons. And they all went, they all fought, they all saw action. I think three of the four were wounded. But then one of them died. Quentin, the youngest son, was shot down in a dogfight over France. And Roosevelt just broke his heart. He would sit in his study pretending to read a book, mumbling Quentin's nickname, Quenty, Quenty, over and over again. And Roosevelt himself was dead within 6 months.
Well, thanks for this program. I mean, this kind of this personal aspects of this, and that, it just seems like he was this genuinely nice man of his time, but I really enjoy your work. So
thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Hope you enjoy this book, too.
Thanks, Dave. Aaron in Cudahy. Hi.
Yes, hello. I want to know who sank the Maine. Did William Randolph Hearst hire somebody to do it? Did the Cuban guerrillas do it? Was it an accident? Who sank the Maine?
I think we can. There are a lot of theories over the years. It was an accident. When we were building battleships, which were actually relatively new contraptions, steel battleships were new contraptions, steel steam battleships were new contraptions in the 1890s. They and these American ships, they built the boiler and the coal for the boiler too close to the powder magazine, and there was a coal fire, and it blew up the Maine. But of course, the Americans didn't want it. They were looking for a provocation to go to war with Cuba, so that they said, no, it wasn't an accident. It was a Spanish torpedo or a Spanish mine. Even though I think there's circumstantial evidence, and I discuss it in the book. book, that they knew better. They knew it really was an accident, but it was much more convenient to say that it was a deliberate provocation by Spain. Many years later, Admiral Rickover of the U.S. Navy commissioned a study, and they concluded that it was almost surely an accident and not a mine.
And thank you for the call, Aaron. Henry in Springfield. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for having the program. It's great. I was intrigued by the mention of William James because I'm a big fan of Louis Menand's book, The Metaphysical Club.
Oh, yeah.
Describes a group of intellectuals all clustered around Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. and others in Cambridge. And I'm wondering, because Holmes was certainly an outstanding jurist at the time, and I'm not sure who named him to the Supreme Court, but it was around that time.
Theodore Roosevelt.
Holmes was very much opposed to the notion of war is glorious. That was part of his writings he kept throughout his life. Was there ever a run-in between Holmes and Roosevelt or Lodge or first?
Well, yeah, I mean, Holmes is an interesting figure because he experienced the Civil War. He was wounded three times. He quit. He came home. And you're right, in some of his writings he warns against war, but in his speeches he would glorify war. I write about this in the book. In 1897 he gives a speech to the graduating seniors at Harvard, and he talks about the divinity of war, that it's a divine experience to have fought. He glorifies war with this group, and it's odd because, you know, Holmes in a way should have known better and at times did know better, having experienced such a tough civil war. But by the time he's now, I guess he's about in his 50s giving these speeches, he is glorifying war, and it has a big effect. He's a clubmate at Harvard of Roosevelt and Lodge, the Forsellian Club, which is this upper-class club social club at Harvard. And then they're all together and influencing each other. I have a little scene in there of commencement. 1897, when Holmes gets an honorary degree, and they're all together. This upper class group of Harvard boys extolled war at this period, and it was considered to be a kind of a rite of manhood, something that was necessary to prove your place on top of society.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Henry. Kurt, Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Good morning, this is Thomas. I'm wondering if a case could be made on a psychosocial analysis kind of basis that Theodore Roosevelt, for instance, came from the genteel aristocracy of that of 19th century America, and their class in terms of wealth, power, prestige, and who was calling the shots. They were being replaced by the industrialists, and they did that. They did not necessarily see eye to eye on things, and in fact, the Roosevelts and people he represented saw the industrialists as crude upstarts, and it made it relatively easier for him to go around trust busting, which of course was a good and necessary thing to do. And if, in our day, of course, the industrialists are being replaced by the financiers, yeah, and so forth. So power, the interests of the rich and the powerful are not always identical.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you put your finger on something. There are class warfare even within the upper class. In this case, it's the rising industrial class, the arrivis, if you want, the parvenus, and both Roosevelt and Lodge were, insofar as America has an aristocracy, and we can debate that, they were about as aristocratic as you get. I mean, Lodge was a Boston Brahmin, you know, that saying about the Cabots speak only to the Lowells, and the Lowells speak only to God, or whatever it is. And Roosevelt was a Knickerbocker, a New York Knickerbocker, and they considered themselves to be this kind of upper class that looked down a bit on the industrialists, the new people coming along who they thought were more selfish. Lodge and Roosevelt believed they held to a higher, kind of more noble ideal of Americanism than these money-grubbing industrialists. Now, you can exaggerate all this because there's obviously a lot of intermarrying and money ultimately talks. But there is a tenor in the letters of Lodge and Roosevelt where they are looking down their nose at these rich industrialists who are just looking after their own wallets and not considering more elevated interests, more national interests, or just the kind of glory of manhood As I said earlier, the businessmen initially were against the war. They were worried that it would drive down the stock market. And Roosevelt and Lodge are kind of contemptuous of their business friends who are worried about their pocketbooks when they ought to be worrying about higher values like triumph and glory for the United States. Mm.
Thanks, Kurt, so much for the call. Well, you're a great guest. Thank you, Evan, so much for being with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this. Good callers.
Aren't they? Yeah, it's a really great audience.
Interesting and educated.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you. Evan Thomas, The War Lovers, Roosevelt, Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. You may have read one of his other books. And it was referenced by one of our callers, Sea of Thunder, the bestseller also. John Paul Jones, Robert Kennedy, The Very Best Men, The Man to See, and The Wise Men. He's an editor-at-large at Newsweek. Darn, we never got to a discussion of Newsweek. But there was plenty to talk about, and we didn't get to some of what's in the book, but that'll happen. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this program, and to Chrissy as well for doing our on-air production. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9. Thank you for listening.